if you like, but I think probably best if I try to.
If you talk introductory.
Yeah, don't worry, I don't need it. I'll do with Emma. Yeah. So, what this is about, it's about models of inclusivism. Right, now in the text that Ellis sent round, it gave a number, three models, four models. These models of inclusivism sort of interleave, so I'm not quite sure how many there are. But I just want to take a few models of inclusivism in ultra-Orthodox Jewish thought. You see, you've got an interesting situation for any religious... Oh, you need to change the sign. You've got an interesting situation for any religious personality. Are you okay, or do you want to? Yeah, right. Any religious personality, I'm not sure whether there may be certain religions which don't have this sort of polarity, and there may well be, but I'm not, my field is not comparative religion. But once a religion proclaims that something is desirable, is good, is right, and another thing is wrong, so then you have the question of the people inside who are right and the people outside who are wrong. This doesn't have to be religion. It could be communism. A friend of mine, his departed parents were devoted communists and in Poland. And his father at some point was, while they were not yet really married, his father was put in prison. And there was one day when his mother, then the fiancée, was able to come and meet him. And they had, and he was recording the life story of his parents individually. So his father told him about this day, what happened. We met and we discussed Marxist philosophy. He wanted to make sure she was still on the right side. her version of it was that she brought some soup for him and he looked very, very pale and hungry. So you've got orthodoxies and unorthodoxies, and you've got the way of dealing with that. So you've got people inside and people outside. The tremendous debates that took place at the beginning of the 20th century about modern art, the beginnings of abstract art with Kandinsky and so on. So are you inside or are you outside? So it was, with ridiculing the Victorian representational art of the past. So you took a position and there was a kind of an exclusivist way of seeing things. So this saint and sinner kind of where there really are two poles, two ends of the spectrum, they don't quite meet. Then you have the interesting issue about the saint and the sinner, yes, redeeming the sinner, which is a very dramatic idea, and which we have in Jewish thought, and of course comes into Christian thought. It's picked up this concept. There's a fascinating concept in the Zohar, in the Holy Zohar, that the great spiritual teachers go down into hell in order to rescue the sinner who is there in this negative realm. So this idea of redemption and of forgiveness, and the point where the great spiritual person joins together with the terrible sinner. Now, that as a paradigm is an interesting idea, but how does it work in actual society? Especially when we add into the mixture, we add another ingredient, which is modernity. Because what happens with modernity is that you have a general sense of breakdown of barriers, of walls, of different kinds, and faced with that, you have to have a bolstering of the walls in order to keep it there at all, because people feel if you don't, if you're not more strict in some way, then you will lose the whole spiritual message that you've got, and you have a group or a tendency which will say, "Listen, let's relax the walls. Let's cut. Let's snip things off. Let's modernize." And you then get what in Judaism became non-orthodox versions of Judaism. So you get versions of people who want to identify with Jewish thought and with Jewish culture and history. And we will see within the text of this possibly an explanation why. And yet want to cut off anything which is inconvenient in the modern context. However, you have others, a contrary tendency, which wants to preserve what they see as the original, traditional message of Jewish thought. And then comes the question, is this an exclusivist stance, necessarily, or can there be an inclusive version of ultra-Orthodoxy, right? So that's what I'm looking at. The idea that you have an inclusivist version of ultra-Orthodoxy. Does that make sense so far? That's my question to you. Yes? You understand what I'm trying to get at? If you don't have ultra-Orthodoxy, that's fine. You can have progressive forms of Judaism or of any religion, and so then you don't have a problem. But if you want to preserve the ultra-Orthodox fine print, yes, a lot of these books, they've got like the main part, like the Code of Law. There's the main paragraphs in the Code of Law, and then you've got the fine print. So you can say the ultra-Orthodox, they keep the fine print, or even the middle. And then you have bits being cut out as a process of modernization. Okay, so we're looking at metaphors or models of inclusivism.
What do you mean, can a single individual participate in both, or can someone who's an exclusivist find room in his heart or in his mind for people who don't do what he does?
Well, what we're trying to see is how the Hasidic movement, with some difficulty, tried to combine both the intensity of pre-modern traditionalism with a postmodern form of inclusivism, right? So that's...
It means it's a single individual would embrace both worlds, in other words.
Yes, yeah. Well, a single individual or a whole society.
Well, I think that this is an admirable objective.
You think this is...
I think it's an admirable objective for the ultra-Orthodox to consider inclusivism. And I think Chabad actually goes a long way to doing that by including almost anybody, as is evidenced by this meeting, for example, in a certain way, and not turning people away or despising them. Mm. So that's a good thing. And I like the kind of openness that, for example, Nadine Steinsaltz showed when he came, because his thought embraces the whole world. But his point of view is that, like, for example, Israeli society, he condemns for its nature, but yet he lives within it. So I think the point is that people who are going to... I think Israel just kind of puts the focus on the issues, really, in an interesting way, because I think where I have a real difficulty is not in Britain, but with ultra-Orthodox people who say that the law of the state doesn't apply in Israel. It applies everywhere else, but not in Israel. I mean, that's nonsense. I mean, that's where we get the people who won't, the Orthodox people who won't join the army and say they're defending the state by studying in yeshiva. Well, maybe they are in a way, and I would buy into that, but it doesn't excuse them.
Well, Roz, that's a very interesting point. I'd like to take the first part of what you said, the way the Chabad house represents these values of inclusivism. I'm actually trying to give the theological underpinning of the Chabad house. That's what I'm trying to do in this talk. As for your remarks about Israel, you know, that's really another topic, very interesting and important topic, but it's outside the frame for this afternoon. Now, I want to start with the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism. In fact, traditionally, we understand the 18th of Elul as being both his birthday and that of Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the founder of Chabad, and the 18th of Elul is this coming Wednesday. So it's a suitable time to mention both these figures. Now, the Baal Shem Tov gives an interesting parable. You see, in the Baal Shem Tov's time, there were very learned Jews. He living in Eastern Europe in the 18th century, middle of the 18th century. He died in 1760. There were very learned Jews. There were very ignorant Jews. There weren't deliberate atheists, let's say, among the Jewish community, nor for that matter among the Catholic Christian community that the Jews lived among in the Ukraine at that time. There was the French and German Enlightenment, but that was far to the west. That was happening somewhere else. And when the Baal Shem Tov talks about ignorant Jews, he's talking about people who are, as it were, ignorant by default. They're not knowledgeable, though. Now, many of the Baal Shem Tov did not write a book. And what we have from him are occasional stories, metaphors, images, which are quoted by his disciples. And one of these metaphors is the story of the lost prince. Now, the version of this that I'm looking at here, a metaphor of a king who sent away his only son to the distant place. Now, it's interesting, why did he send him away? In order that afterwards he would have more delight. It's the king having more delight when the son finally comes back. Or the son having more delight somehow by realizing how wonderful it is to be in the palace. You know, you could flesh out this image that the king is concerned about his son having a proper education and realizing what are the responsibilities of leadership and of being a member of the royal family. So he sends him away to some distant place where he's in a kind of a village. And in the great length of days, the son, the prince, forgets all the delights of the palace. And in fact, in other versions of the same story, he forgets the language of the palace. He forgets what clothes they wear in the palace. He becomes completely transformed into something else. And then the king sent messages to the son, and the son doesn't want to come back to the king. Whatever the king said to him, he sent more and more important princes to the ministers, to the son. The son took no notice. Till he sent to him a certain wise man who changed his clothes and changed his language in order to be more similar to the son. And then he was able to come close to the son and he was able to bring him back to his father. And that's a very interesting image, and it can be understood as the foundation of the Hasidic movement. That here we have the idea that the son, who is the Jewish person, who has in some way drifted away, maybe through generations of poverty, ignorance, there's an interesting process in late medieval Jewish society where wealth and scholarship move together. Wealth and scholarship move together because the wealthy businessman wants to find a husband for his daughter, and so he comes to the yeshiva and he says, "Who is your best scholar? I'll give them a beautiful house and so on. I'll look after them." And so the very good scholar marries this businessman's daughter, so gradually you have wealth and scholarship coming together, leaving ignorance and poverty on the outside. That's one of the processes in Jewish society. The Marxists came from the scholars. They left the yeshiva and became Marxists. So there we have this image of the Baal Shem Tov, and it's a way of understanding the way in which the spiritual person redeems the person who is somehow outside the pale. Now, the Baal Shem Tov passed away in 1760. He was his successor in the Hasidic movement was called Rabbi Dov Ber, the Maggid of Mezrich. The third great figure in the Hasidic movement, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Lavdi, was the founder of Chabad, and he wrote a book, Tanya, and in the book Tanya, in chapter 32, there's a very interesting discussion of the first of my models in the list I gave Ellie. It was the last, but it's actually the first of the models. It's called Ahavat Yisrael, love of one's fellow. Now we have here an interesting issue that the more the inclusivism is expressed within the Jewish community as a whole, in other words, however great a sinner the person is as a Jew, he or she is still part of the Jewish community. At the same time, we face a greater seemingly greater exclusivism in terms of the Jew versus non-Jewish society. So at the moment, what we're going to do is just consider the issue for the Jew, and then we will look at the question of the Jew and non-Jewish society as well. Okay, so bear with me while we go through a few steps in terms of looking at this just in terms of Jewish people. So in chapter 32 of Tanya, and chapter the number 32 in Hebrew is Lamed Bet, and that means Lev, which means heart. And it's often described as the heart of Tanya. It's what Tanya is really about. It's a chapter that the author added when he was having the manuscript printed. He added this chapter. He added a few chapters, and this was one of them. And it's as if it gives more clearly what the message of Tanya is. Tanya was printed in 1796 and is the central text of the Chabad movement. It's studied by many other Hasidic scholars as well. So he speaks about the virtue of love of one's fellow. And he refers to the story, the famous story of Hillel. Hillel was asked, tell me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot. He said, what you don't like, don't do to anyone else. That's the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and study. So Rabbi Shneur Zalman takes this concept and says, well, what does this mean? This means caring for another person. That is the centrality of Jewish thought. And he then looks through. He was a great halachist, and he's able to survey the Talmud, and he is not shy to point to contrary statements. The Talmud seems to say something that sounds the opposite. See, he says, first of all, if you look at people in terms of the soul rather than the body, and the body would include the sort of character of the persons. You may have a person with a bad character and bad behavior, but nonetheless, the soul is pure. So if you focus on the soul, everyone's soul is pure, you can love everyone. Then he says, but wait a minute, the Talmud says, he quotes the Talmud says that if someone sees his friend sinning, he should hate him. And he should tell their teacher, so-and-so, he should tell tales. So-and-so did something wrong, and so his teacher should also hate him. Sounds shocking. the interesting thing about the Talmud is the Talmud speaks on so many different levels. It'll say this thing here, and it'll say the opposite somewhere else. And the scholars have to fit together. You know, that it's a three or four or n-dimensional communication of divine teaching. And so what Rabbi Shneur Zalman says, it's a very neat thing over here. He says, this is talking about your peer. It's someone in your own class. Someone in your own class is secretly taking drugs. What do you do? Do you keep quiet about it? You're not going to snitch on anyone. Or do you think at the age of 15, let's say, that this is something you've got to tell your teacher about because really there's something very dangerous going on? So he says, this is your peer who is doing something wrong. And you know what? You have rebuked your peer. You told them it's really stupid. You shouldn't be doing this. You're doing something wrong. Dangerous. It's dangerous for you. It's dangerous for other people. And they haven't listened. Okay, so that's why you now have to snitch on them and tell your teacher and so on. But someone who is not your peer, who is just an ignorant person outside the group, you're a scholar inside the yeshiva, you're studying, or the seminary, you're studying, and there's someone outside, that person, you have to draw close with cords of love. And with your love to them, maybe you can help them start doing positive things instead of negative things. And then what to me is the most important line in this chapter and perhaps in the whole book. And if they don't change, you haven't lost the good deed of love of one's fellow. In other words, love them even if they can continue to do bad things just the same way. So you've got a person, you are, so to speak, inside, and there's someone who is outside due to their behavior, and you love them, and the love does not, if the love has an effect and they become someone who's like inside the circle, well, that's wonderful. But it might not happen that way. They may insist, you know what, I'm a drug addict, finished. Well, actually, we're not talking here, the drug addict was the peer. But let's say, so this is another drug addict, yeah, a second or worse, whatever it is. So the second person is doing terrible things and they go on doing terrible things. But Tanya says, you go on loving. It's a very, very interesting statement. Then he turns back to your peer and he says, you know what? The person, the girl in your own class, you can't just hate them because of the negative. You've got to love them as well because of the soul inside them which is suffering. They don't want them. The soul suffers because of the bad things we do. So if someone's a drug addict, so the soul is very upset that I'm inside someone who is stupid enough to be a drug addict. So, or to have let themselves get into that situation. So you love the soul of the other person, and eventually, and you have mercy on them. You feel sorry for them, and the mercy changes the hate to love, so you love them on both sides. You started off hatred one side for the drug addiction, and love for the soul, and you end up loving them all together. Well, but they might still be a drug addict. Yeah, it's a bit like the Braslov story of the prince under the table who thought he was a turkey, and the sage comes underneath and says, I'm also a turkey, and manages to get the prince out from under the table, but he remains a turkey. So, all right, so that's Rabbi Shneur Zalman's metaphor of love of one's fellow. We then come to a historical process that I want to treat very quickly. We're talking about things at the end of the 18th century, then comes the 19th century, the reform movement beginning in Central Europe, the reaction among Eastern European Jewry, and among the Hungarian Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox Hungarians, which has an effect on modern Israel, incidentally. So in 1865, they had a meeting in a town called Michalovce, and they devised a kind of a set of rules which really become the sort of the format of ultra-Orthodox Judaism of today at its most extreme form. And it was an exclusive, an intensely exclusivist system. Now that's one kind of phenomenon happening in Hungary, which is in, we can regard for this moment as Eastern Europe, in Central Europe, a different kind of model began, and that is described by someone called Adam Fursiger in his book Exclusion and Hierarchy. You should get that book from the library if you haven't got it. What Adam writes about is the way you have a hierarchical model in Central Europe, where you have the observant and knowledgeable people at the top, and then becomes more and more ignorant, and then, you know, like reform, who don't observe and don't know. But from the point of view of the people at the top of the hierarchy, they're all Jews. They're all part of it somehow. But the problem is, when you are conscious of a hierarchy and you feel you're at the top of the pyramid, oh yeah, we're at the top of this pyramid. You know why we're at the top? How I can demonstrate to you the top? Because we live in a certain synagogue. We go to a certain synagogue. Only people at the top go to that synagogue. And we do certain things. Only people at the top do that. So people who don't do X, Y, Z, they're at the bottom. So you soon get a certain social gradation which has problems of its own. Now, we're moving. So many of the Hasidic groups, including Hasidic groups in Israel, for example, were dragged or swept into or flowed into whatever the enclave exclusivist model of Hungarian Orthodoxy, which became the model of Satmar Hasidism, and especially after the war, Satmar Hasidism exerted a tremendously strong influence on other Hasidic groups as well, except Lubavitch, and there was a conflict between Satmar and Lubavitch, which is still there, and it's a theological conflict, not a real conflict. When Satmar Hasidim were being attacked, when Lubavitch Hasidim were being attacked in the 1990s, 1991, I think it was, 1990, in Crown Heights in New York, there were people coming and attacking the Hasidim of Crown Heights. Busloads of Satmar Hasidim drove in to protect them. So theologically, there's an argument, but in terms of people, there's a bond. Now, I want to look at the way, in our few minutes here, the way in which the inclusivist ideal was revived within Lubavitch, particularly by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, and then immeasurably broadened by his son-in-law and successor, the seventh Lubavitch Rebbe, the person we generally call the Lubavitch Rebbe, the picture of him over there. And there are a number of different phrases, mottos, slogans, or quotations which express this inclusivist idea. The first one I'm looking at is, although he sinned, he is an Israelite. An Israelite, even though he sins, remains an Israelite. Now, the Talmud tells us this in a context which has nothing to do with ordinary society. It's talking about something happening in the book of Joshua. Book of Joshua, Joshua miraculously conquered the city of Jericho, and the gold, silver, and valuables of the city were declared sacred. They mustn't be used. However, Achan was the person who took from this sacred stuff and appropriated it for himself and hid it in his tent. As a result, the next battle that they had, which was against the town of Ai, a number of Jewish soldiers were killed. And Joshua was very upset. Why were they killed? God said, Israel, to Joshua, Israel has sinned. So that's why these people were killed in the battle against Ai. Now, Israel has sinned means the people Israel, you would imagine. Achan was one individual. So it's the people Israel has sinned by the fact that there's this one individual who's done something wrong. And the Talmud points out, even though God is talking about them sinning, they're still called Israel. Now, Israel, like Rabbi Yisrael, Israel is a a term of greatness. There's Jacob, who had his name changed to Israel. Israel is the one who struggles with angels and with men. Israel represents the greatness of the Jew. So even though they sinned, they're still called Israel. Now, 5 centuries or so after the redaction of the Talmud, this Agadic teaching was adapted by Rashi in a very, very practical responsum. Some Jewish people had forcibly been converted to Christianity in the wake of the First Crusade, talking about around 1096. And this group of people included a man and a woman who decided they wanted to get married. They carried out a Jewish marriage ceremony, even though they'd all been converted to Christianity, but they did it more or less in a Jewish way. And then sometime later, they were able to come back to Judaism. And now, as it happens, unfortunately, the man and the woman wanted to part. They didn't want to be married anymore. So the question came up to Rashi, does this woman need a Jewish divorce? They were all converted to Christianity when they got married. So does this marriage count in any way? So Rashi says, even if they had been willing converts to Christianity, he would still say that the laws of Judaism apply to them, and the act of marriage that they took part in together was effective, and therefore she needs a Jewish divorce. Because, he said, a Jew, even though he sinned, he's still a Jew. In other words, he's adapting the biblical story as seen through the eyes of the Talmud, and he's expressing it in such a way that a Jew is always a Jew. Now this concept, he also used the same idea whether you to apply to the question, if you're making a minyan, you need 10 Jewish men for a minyan. What happens if one of them, or 9 of them, are transgressors? They do all kinds of things wrong. They eat non-kosher food, they do this or that. Makes no difference. Or it could be all 10 of them. I suppose you have to have one of them who's asking the question. But but according to Rashi, even a Jew, even though he sinned, he's still a Jew, and they are all Jewish people, even though they're not keeping Jewish law properly. Now that's, one could expand on this. This is something very hard for the British government to understand, and that's why we have the conflict over the schools, Jewish schools today, because the government believes, and the legal system believes, that a Jew is someone who professes Judaism, who keeps Jewish law. Whereas Judaism says a Jew is a Jew whether or not they keep Jewish law. So that's a subject in itself. Now, this became a very powerful theme in halachic literature later on. Coming down to Rabbi Shneur Zalman, when he was writing his code of law, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the Hasidic author of Tanya, great ancestor of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he also wrote about this, that even a sinner can be included in a minyan, quoting the same idea that a Jew, even if he sins, nonetheless he's always a Jew. Okay, so that's one image, and we have, when we come to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he uses this very extensively. There's an early published text which interleaves with another model that the Lubavitcher Rebbe has, the 4 sons at the Seder table. Here you have this dramatic expression of the nature of the Jewish family. The Haggadah, the Passover Haggadah, tells us that the Torah speaks about 4 sons. One is wise, and one is wicked, one is simple, and one doesn't know how to ask. And there they all are, sitting at the Seder table. Now this became a whole motif for the Lubavitcher Rebbe in an appeal that he made to rabbis and scholars. He wrote an open letter to yeshivot, which were not the Lubavitch yeshivot, the other yeshivot, all yeshivot, asking them, pointing out that you got the wise son and the wicked son next to each other. Why are they sitting next to each other? First of all, you think the wicked son is so negative? I want to tell you, he says, even though he sinned, he's still a Jew. He quotes this idea. And why does the author of the Haggadah put them together at this table? One is wise, one is wicked. He could have put them in order of like affirmation of Judaism. One is wise, one is simple, one doesn't know how to ask. And right at the bottom, you've got one who is wicked. No, the wise son is next to the wicked son so that they can talk to each other. So that the wise son can talk to the wicked son and get him to somehow inspire him that he shouldn't be so wicked, or at least he's got a connection and he'll send him a text message next time something interesting has happened. So to make that connection between the wise and the wicked, the wise in this sense means affirming. Yes, the affirming and the rejecting. So this is another image. I want to take another one as well. Every Jew has a portion in the world to come. Now every Saturday at this part of the year, we say Pirkei Avot. And we begin, although Pirkei Avot is one tractate all to itself, we begin with a quotation from another tractate from Sanhedrin. Every Jew has a portion in the world to come. As it says, your people are all righteous, they shall inherit the land forever, they're the branch of my planting, the work of my hands, in which to take pride, from Isaiah chapter 60. All right, now, many people know this. Is there anyone who has heard of this phrase, every Jew has a portion in the world to come? Okay. Does it literally mean every Jew? Is it really every Jew? The Mishnah actually goes on in a bit which is quoted less. That's the nature of Jewish thought. And the next line, it's not the next Mishnah, it's just the next line in the same Mishnah. And these are the ones who don't have a portion in the world to come. One who says the doctrine of the revival of the dead is not from the Torah. It doesn't say someone who doesn't believe in the doctrine of the revival of the dead. He believes in it, or she, but he doesn't agree it's actually in the written law. So that person doesn't have a portion in the world to come. Or he thinks the Torah is not from heaven. Or an apikoros, which has all kinds of different interpretations. Rabbi Akiva says also one who reads external books, which might mean the Apocrypha, or it might mean secular Greek books. One who utters a spell on a wound. And there's a whole list of people. You end up wondering who fits into this, who actually does have a portion in the world to come, especially in a modern context, when hardly anyone believes in anything. So there's a movement, you know, the synagogues where they want to rephrase the prayers so they don't exactly mention God. So in this context, who's got a portion in the world to come? Now, the Leila Babitcher Rebbe, before he was Rebbe, in 1943, he became Rebbe in 1950 when his father-in-law passed away. He formally accepted the Rebbe quality a year later. But here, 7 years earlier, he's in America, and he gave a talk at an event. It was a Siyum of Mishnayos. People had studied Mishnah, and he gave a talk at the conclusion of this study where he emphasized very much this idea, every single Jew has a portion in the world to come. So someone wrote to him, a respectable rabbi called Stockhammer, Rabbi David Stockhammer, wrote to him and said, what do you mean everyone's got a portion in the world to come? The Mishnah goes straight on and says a whole lot of people who don't. Even in Pirkei Avot, it also talks about people who don't have a portion in the world to come because of this and because of that. It doesn't seem such an easy thing to have. So in 1946, the Rebbe wrote back to Stockhammer. And whatever he wrote back to him, he turned into an article which was published in 1946 in a kind of a journal which Lubavitch published at that time called Kovetz Lubavitch. It's an essay. And he goes through all kinds of different sources proving that ultimately everyone does have a portion in the world to come. Yes, the person might have done the worst sins and they might be in such a category, but he's able to prove this by adopting a particular interpretation of what is meant by the world to come. Now, this issue about the world to come is expressed in these pages here. These pages here of the Rambam, Maimonides, Laws of Tshuva, Laws of Repentance, chapter 8, section 2, in which the Rambam, Maimonides, talks about what is the world to come. And it's clear that he uses the words to mean what you might otherwise call the Garden of Eden. In other words, a spiritual realm where only souls are. The Raivad, who is the famous critic of the Rambam, Rabbi Avraham ben David of Poskia, you see this long criticism, full of scorn. This writer says, he says, what's he talking about? The world to come means the time of the revival of the dead. In fact, Maimonides wrote 13 principles of faith. The 12th principle is about the coming of the Messiah. The 13th principle is the idea of the revival of the dead. So the Raivad says the world to come means the time when people, the dead will be revived after the coming of the Messiah. So the Kesef Mishnah, the Kesef Mishnah, which is written by Rabbi Joseph Caro, who also wrote the Code of Law, he says, look, it's just a question of terminology. The Rambam is talking about the world to come in terms of the Garden of Eden, the world of souls. And the Raivad is talking about the world to come as the time of the revival of the dead. They actually do not have any real disagreement whatsoever. It's just an issue of terminology. All right, whether that's the last word on the subject, but What the Lubavitcher Rebbe does, he takes the interpretation of the world to come as meaning the revival of the dead. And he proves from Kabbalistic sources, particularly he quotes from an interesting Kabbalistic source of Rabbi Isaac Luria's thought, that ultimately every single Jew, whatever he's done or she's done, they go through a whole process. They might have done such bad things that they don't get into the Garden of Eden. But they will have the revival of the dead. They might even have done such bad things. If you look at the Kabbalistic sources, the Rebbe doesn't quote this, but if you look at those sources, they say he might have done something so bad that the body that he had in this world can't come back. So he'll have to be given another body. So the idea of transmigration of souls helps that along. So eventually everyone has the revival of the dead. So now this concept of every single Jew having a portion in the world to come, so we have when in 1952, shortly after that Passover, when that Passover letter was written, it's at that time of that Passover that there's the real focus of the late Lubavitcher Rebbe's inclusivist concepts, and they were poured out through the successive decades of his leadership at a certain point leading to the construction of Chabad houses like this. I said this is a quotation from something he said shortly after Passover. I said earlier that without any limits, one should be active in outreach towards other people. A person might say, why should I waste my time with him? In that time that I could spend with him, instead of that, I could sit and study Torah. How can I give up my time for another person who is so low? On that account, one is told every Jew has a portion in the world to come. One doesn't know who is higher. Perhaps the other person is higher than you are. Now, this is different to the hierarchical principle that Fertziger was talking about in Central Europe. The hierarchical principle means that you're convinced you're at the top because you go to this synagogue, and the other people are at the bottom because they go to that synagogue or they don't go to synagogue at all. Here he's saying you don't know who is higher. Perhaps the other person's higher than you are. through giving up your time and doing a favor for the other person by teaching him about Judaism, you mean? In the world to come, maybe he'll recompense you. And he says a very interesting thing that he goes on to say, remember that we saw all these restrictions on who has a portion in the world to come. He goes on to say, the ignorant, simple person, so to speak, ignorant about Judaism, yes, might be a great professor, that person's definitely got a portion in the world to come. Why? Because if they're not keeping Judaism, they're like a child taken captive by Gentiles. Now, a child taken captive by Gentiles is something described in the Talmud, that child is innocent. A child taken captive by bandits, a group of bandits, a gang, kidnapped a child, brought the child up and taught him to steal. And he has to go and steal. Now, is this, and so now the child is 14 years old. Can you blame that person? He's now an accomplished thief. Who has taught him anything else? He's taught that very good, you stole, that's wonderful. You didn't steal, smack, you know. So this child is, he's been taught that he's supposed to steal. Or he's been taught that he's supposed to, you're not cool if you believe in God, or if you do this, or if you keep whatever it is. So in other words, the person that you, the rabbinic scholar, are talking to, that person definitely gets a portion in the world to come because they're totally innocent. They're a child taken captive by Gentiles, by bandits. Sorry. But you, who says you will get to the world to come? The Mishnah has so many exclusions, maybe you are fit into those exclusions. Maybe you're excluded from the world to come. But because you did a favor to that ignorant Jew by getting him to don tefillin or keep Shabbat, that Jew will recompense the scholar in the world to come. And what will he do? He will get the scholar out of Gehenna, rescue him, and bring him to the Garden of Eden. That's a very interesting idea, which the Talmud actually says in Yuma, page 87a, where it says, Kol hamazaket harabim, anyone who brings merit to the many, gets no sin happens for him. Why not? Because you can't have him in Gehenna, in hell, and his student is in the Garden of Eden. So that means the simple people whom the scholar is communicating to, they're in the Garden of Eden, and they will rescue the scholar from Gehenna. So in other words, it's very much for the benefit of the scholar that he helps the simple Jew. And the final image is the image of the Torah scroll image. There's an ancient idea that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah scroll. In fact, they're not that number. It's a different number, but there's a way of explaining that. And there is also the concept in the Book of Exodus that there were 600,000 Jews who came out of Egypt. From there comes the idea that each Jew has a letter in the Torah scroll, which a 17th century Kabbalist who was a mystical rabbi, Rabbi Nathan Netta Shapira, who was in Krakow in the 17th century, he says this shows us that each Jew has a letter in the Torah scroll. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I couldn't find anyone saying this earlier, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, if that's the case, if each Jew is like a letter in the Torah scroll, you need to have every single Jew in the Jewish people. You can't do without any one individual. Just the same way that a Torah scroll, if one letter is missing, you can't use it. If we take the Torah out of the ark and they unroll it and they suddenly see there's a mistake or a letter has faded or something like that, they can't use it. There are all kinds of rules what they have to do. But you need every single letter. So in the same way, you need every single Jew. All right, so that establishes this inclusivist concept, which at the same time, there is this postmodern inclusivist view, including every Jew, and at the same time keeping all the small print of the code of law and not shaking hands with women and all the other dimensions which distinguish the Haredi or male or female or, you know, shetels, this, that, the other, all the other dimensions of the Haredi person, but with a tremendous inclusivist view. Now, then we have, what about the Gentile? The late Lubavitcher Rebbe was also concerned about the spirituality of the Gentile. Funnily enough, this doesn't begin with him, but with Rabbi Schneur Zalman, the founder of Chabad. And there's a very interesting, Rabbi Schneur Zalman got to know Tsar Alexander the First. And as you know, Tsar Alexander was a very religious personality. And Rabbi Schneur Zalman was impressed by his religiosity. He was impressed that his response to the Napoleonic, his victory against Napoleon in 1812, he was impressed that the Tsar understood this as the hand of God. Not the might of man, but the hand of God. And this struck him, and his son, Rabbi Dov Ber, the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, talks about this, the way his father was impressed by the religiosity of the Tsar. And some years later, Rabbi Dov Ber wrote a tract addressed to a non-Jewish Russian leader talking about spiritual things in Judaism. Now this leads on to Rabbi Menachem Schneerson campaigning for the seven Noahide laws, quoting from a passage in the Maimonides book. Maimonides is often seen as a universalist in medieval Jewry. And he wrote about the way that the Jew has the duty to communicate the seven Noahide laws to non-Jews. And with that, by talking about this in the early 1980s, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, set the stage for an inclusivist concept, which in fact, although it preserves the exclusive identity of the Jew, also has room for every human being. And then that was followed with the thrust to make more and more Chabad houses. So there we have the theology of the Chabad house. And I think that... okay, there was... I think that's basically it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So we have just a few minutes of questions. If there are any questions.
I have a question, but I'm really, if other people have questions, let them go first. I don't know about that. You mentioned at the beginning that people have their own world, not in these words, people have their own world views, and they have to be able to justify other things in their own terms. You didn't say those words, but I'm imposing that concept on what you said, to live up to what I'm saying, to that very idea. But so you're speaking about inclusivism. Yes, indeed. So people are finding a way of justifying in their own reality the presence so that eventually this person not to blame, will come around. Maybe he's innocent, or maybe he'll do his one thing that will be very meaningful, even though he won't conventionally keep the entire thing like you do. But it's an inclusivism that's predicated on nevertheless maintaining your world view. It's not an inclusivism that says, look, I have mine, he has his.
It's not pluralism.
His is just as valid as
you're
mine.
You're right. It's not pluralism.
Yeah, it's not pluralism.
It does have a definite religious ethic. But what's interesting is the ability within this religious ethic to include every person.
Yeah, as long as somehow or other that person will come around or will be...
Well, yeah, but he might not do that in this lifetime.
He might not come around, but somehow you have to justify... It's in Rabbi Soloveitchik of Boston, Rabbi Joseph O. Soloveitchik, in his book Lonely Man of Faith, seems to take a slightly different track, but I think maybe it comes down to the same thing. He says there are two stories of Adam, and the first one in chapter 1 of Genesis, second chapter of Genesis. The one in chapter 2 of Genesis is a seeker. The one in chapter 1 of Genesis is someone who goes out there in the world and accomplishes, builds, and they said that that first person, even though he's not a seeker and he's not really entering a covenant with God, is still doing a divine mandate. So in a way, he's opening up a space where these people, even if they never take on the religious thing, he's saying that chapter one has value in and of itself, but he's also justifying it in terms of some mandate that's put forth in the Bible. It's all, it remains.
Yeah, I mean, you could draw lines connecting that with Rav Kook's view of the secular Zionists, you know, given that Rav Kook's a Zionist, and so a secular Zionist also has a role in the whole enterprise.
They're building the temple.
They don't know it, but the donkey, However, for the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the context is certainly the Talmud, Kabbalah, and biblical teaching. And what he wants to do is, rather than the castigating prophets who, you know, tell people how terrible they are and there's going to be destruction, rabbinic thinking which presents, a wall. Some people are this side and others are that side. He wants to emphasize the point of connection, where everyone is connected together, including the sense of responsibility of the Jew towards the non-Jew as well, in terms of the seven Noahide laws.
But how did he relate to people on their own terms? Was he able to do that? I think he did. I know there is testimony that people felt that he just accepted people as they are, and he didn't place any demands on them, even unspoken demands on them. How does that... He was like a mensch. He was a genuine mensch. He was genuinely open to people as people, apparently, without that other layer of theological baggage or expectation that... I don't know, I'm just wondering if we can square those two things, that he has his worldview and his ultimate values, and then he has this just openness to people as people.
Exactly that. As someone who came into a lot of contact with him said, he was a gentleman.
Yes.
I just remembered what I wanted to say, and it was addressed to what you said.
Oh, right.
At the end of my talk, I'd forgotten something. What the Lubavitcher Rebbe's goal was to transform the Haredi Jew, the people that you're talking about in Israel. He wants to transform them just as much as he wants to transform Jews who eat pork on Yom Kippur. And so for that reason, for example, in Israel, there are outreach centers which function for Haredi Jews. There's a Chabad house, in many Chabad houses all over Israel, which function for Jews who were brought up in a kibbutz and don't keep Shabbat or anything. And there are also a different kind of building called Heichal Menachem, which is a library. We've got one in Stamford Hill as well. And people come in, people with long pears and beards come into the library and they start studying these Hasidic teachings with all different dimensions to them, including this inclusivist message, with the hope that ultimately they will be transformed, whether in this lifetime or the next.
Okay,
right, now your cut.
I was coming at what I said before in another slightly less detailed way, so let's see what you just got to say to what I got to say. So, when I was in Israel, I went to Orpan, and the newspapers were full of pictures of Haredi Jews jeering and throwing stones at dusty girls who were going to school dressed roughly like this. what would your... houses.
I think it's horrific.
Say, well, why haven't people, Lubavitcher rabbis, come out and condemned this publicly?
They have. There were, at that time, there were a lot of public condemnation. Mm. Yeah, they were very vociferous about it.
Didn't see any in the press.
Well, you have to read the Haredi press.
I did, actually.
Yeah.
I did. And there was nothing, but maybe it wasn't Lubavitch.
No.
Can I ask a question? Is there...
Hold on 1 second. No, but around the world, there are many Lubavitchers who, like Eli, run a Chabad house and put out like a weekly message of some kind, a weekly email. Many referred to those incidents in Beit Shemesh in their, you know, someone could do some kind of study of just seeing what were the responses of Chabad around the world. You know, but there were definite response. It wasn't treated as something which, oh well, it just happens. It was taken very seriously as a very, very bad, a distortion of what Jewish teaching is saying.
So you're saying that within Lubavitch, the inclusiveness, the spirit that you're describing would exclude actions of that kind?
Yes.
So I think that example is...
I just wanted to say that, you know, a lot of people you talk to, whether they're secular Israelis or even non-Jews, actually do love all Haredim together.
Mm, yeah.
And there are so many things said or done by Haredim which Lubavitch would condemn. Actually.
Yes.
Not just that. I mean, terrible things, you know, announcement by some rabbi that people should never let a room to an Arab, or to say that Arabs are a lower class than Jews, or many even, or that some dreadful accident that happened at a wedding is by divine decree because they're not orthodox enough.
There's what Haredim say, and then there are other people who see all Jews as one group, whether they're Haredi or completely secular, would be secular. In the 1840s, there was a lot of campaigning in Russia between the educated, enlightened, secularized, modernized Jews. And on the other hand, there were the Hasidim and the Haredi Jews of the time. And the Russian minister, I think it was him, Uvarov, who was in charge of what was happening, who really wanted to starve a third of the Jews to death, convert a third of them to Christianity, and throw a third of them out of Russia. That was his goal. He said, I can't tell any difference between these different kinds of Jew. You know, so one was coming along saying, we're modern, we've read Goethe, we know all about this and that. You know, so...
Yeah, and people still talk to me like that, by the way.
Yes.
They say, why did so-and-so behave like that? As if I could understand it, because I must be the same, because I'm Jewish. It's still going on.
Well, that's right. In fact, it brings home the idea that every Jew, whatever situation we're in, actually we carry the whole burden of Judaism. And, you know, that image, it's a very powerful image.
Isn't the similarity between what you're talking about and radical Islam? A lot of Muslims say, I think radical Islam is wrong and all the rest of it. But it's the people who count, who don't actually come out and say that these people are wrong. So similar to that, within Judaism, I believe that the people who count within even Orthodox Judaism don't come out and say that these people, Haredi, are actually wrong. They're not part of us, as it were.
Yeah,
they don't represent us.
Well, they don't represent our view, but no one's going to say they're not part of the Jewish people.
Well, they're part of the Jewish community.
But if you look at any, Orthodox expression of Orthodoxy, whether the chief rabbi often writes sermons which get distributed to all the United Synagogues. You know, I don't know how much it's imposed that everyone has to deliver the same sermon, but it's certainly advised that they should take that on board, considering their sermon for that Sabbath. And he very often, in exactly this spirit, his first book was a translation of the Lubavitch Rebbe's writings. Torah studies, which we have on the shelf here. So he very often expresses criticism of what is taking place in the Jewish community.
Because the non-Jewish community only sees Jews, they see one religion, which is Judaism, yeah. And everything, no matter where it comes from, is tarred with that brush, basically, within
whatever we do, we're tarred.
Yeah.
You know, we are in modern Russia, we're hated, in modern CIS, we're hated because we began communism.
On another front, I mean, whereas as a secular Jew, I think it works both ways, actually. With Orthodox, with Chabad saying, we accept all Jews, all Jews as Jews, regardless of what they do or what they don't do. From my point of view, it's a way for me to come into contact with Orthodox Judaism without any sort of a feeling of pressure that I have to conform to some way of living or some way of doing things. Where if Chabad didn't exist, then there would be no opportunity for me to do that in a realistic way.
Well, I think that the fact that a person can feel comfortable in a Chabad house comes from the recognition that the people who, let's say, run a Chabad house, yes, Eli, Freddy, whoever, the recognition they give to every other human being, and particularly to every Jew. And this idea that we have here from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he will go to Gan Eden, he'll go to the Garden of Eden. You are the question. In fact, because Lubavitchers are supposed to study so much Torah teaching, there's even an intriguing statement which is usually said over a glass of vodka. It says in the Talmud that the wicked go to hell for 11 months or 12 months. That's why we say Kaddish for 11 months, because saying Kaddish helps to keep the person out of Gehenna. There's this kind of interaction. But it is said that Lubavitchers go for 2 years, not for 1 year. And the reason is because they know and they still sin. That's a lovely story. I heard from a friend of mine, Tzvi Mark, who is a Dr. Tzvi Mark, who is a scholar of Braslav Hasidism. And he's written a book about Hasidism and Madness or something, the title about Rabbi Nachman of Braslav. A very sensitive reading of Rabbi Nachman. So he told me the following joke. So there was a Braslava who, for one reason or another, after passing away, he went to Gehenna, he went to hell. And he called, you know, God, you're down, you're condemned. Rebbe, Rabbi Nachman, and the tzaddikim, as it says, a famous teaching, the tzaddikim, the righteous, the great spiritual teachers, Rabbi Nachman came, and they have long payers, so earlocks. So he pulled him by his earlocks out of hell and saved him, put him back in the Garden of Eden. Now the same thing happened with the Lubavitcher. And God, why am I down here? Because you sinned, what do you expect? Rebbe, Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rebbe comes along and as you said, yes, now you're here, make a Chabad. Okay, Andy,
one more statement. This is also said over a glass of vodka. Better our hell than their heaven.
So, just to conclude this talk, Russell, thank you very much. I think it, as this idea of inclusivism goes towards everybody, is also inclusivism within. That those who are exclusive, we should be inclusive and be tolerant towards those who are. So I think the Rebbe himself would say there's a branch on the candelabra. So you have 7 branches. One is the inclusive branch, then you have the exclusive branch within a certain framework. And as long as they're not throwing stones, I think we should be tolerant towards those who want to be exclusive, as long as they're not harming somebody else.
Yeah.
And I think that balance, I think, is also those who want to be dressed in a certain way, eat a certain diet, we should be...
Ross isn't bothered about that. It's when they throw stones.
As long as they're not throwing stones and harming others, as John Stuart Mill will say. So I'd like to close today's seminar. So please join me first of all in thanking Dr. Lowenthal for